Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, everybody. This is Ali Milani on Politics Uncensored at FUBAR Radio. We have a jam-packed episode for you this week. We're going to be looking at the Conservative Party. Is it on the cusp of complete electoral destruction? We're going to be talking about the upcoming general election following Sir John Curtis saying Labour have a 99% chance of winning and what a future might look like for the Conservative Party. We're joined by Professor Mark Garnett, senior lecturer at Lancaster University. Later on, we're going to be joined by an old friend of mine, Baroness Carmen Smith, one of the youngest members of the House of Lords, who's just been appointed by the Plaid Cymru Party as a peer. We're going to be talking to her about her experiences. But before we get into all of that, it's the Week Unwrapped. And joining us in the studio, we've got political commentator Ben Cope. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping today?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
We're going to go through some of these stories, Ben, and just get your reactions, your thoughts on some of them and have a quick discussion. And we're going to start where I led the show, which is on the Conservative Party. Two ministers have quit their government roles following forcing Rishi Sunak to reshuffle his team. Robert Halfen announced he was resigning as an education minister, while James Heapy, have I pronounced that right? Heapy, followed through on a previous promise to step down as armed forces minister. Both MPs are stepping down at the next general election. In their place, Leo Doherty will become the Armed Forces Minister and Luke Hall Education Minister. Controversial MP Jonathan Gullis was also made a deputy chair of the party. On Monday, Scott Benton resigned as MP for Blackpool South following the imposition of a Commons ban in the wake of a lobbying scandal. The by-election is due to take place on the 2nd of May. Before we get to the by-election, we have now had a record number of Conservative MPs stepping down. I think it's in the late 60s, 63, which is almost as high as it was in 1997. So 63 Conservative MPs have stepped down. Why are so many running away?
Because they think, well, they're jumping before they think they might get pushed because they think they'll lose their seats. I think particularly for these two ministers to have quit is surprising in a way and a really poor signal for the Conservatives, because you know, even if these two ministers were thinking of standing down as they have signaled that they plan to do, they still had a few months to introduce, you know, some new legislation, some new plans in those areas. And the fact that they think that it's not even worth clinging on and you know, doing that job for a few months, I think suggests that they don't think that there's that much progress being made within the Rishi Sunak government, and I think that's a very poor sign for the government.
So I mean, we'll get into whether this government is just kind of trotting on, but how can the Conservative Party possibly fight an election, even if it is to limit damage to have damage limitations essentially on what the House of Commons will look like, when it's so clear that so many of its most senior members have thrown the towel in?
I think that will be a very effective Labour attack line. You know, why are the rats fleeing the ship? You know, just when they need to be fighting. And I think, I think that'll be tough for the Conservatives. And you know, it'll be another reason why this, you know, the coming election campaign will be really difficult.
Mm-hmm. So some of the discussions in the political world over the last week, specifically, have been whether this is just going to be an electoral disaster and a sort of one-off and a big Labour majority come the next general election, or whether the Conservative Party is looking at an existential crisis, whether it could be outflanked by Reform, for example. We have seen there is some precedent, although I think it's wary, of what happens to parties when they are flanked to their right or to their left and overtaken in the national polls. And there's a lot of discussions as to, you know, if the Tory party isn't sort of swallowed up by the more reform thinking Tory MPs in the next leadership election, then they could either be looking at a split or complete wipeout for the Tories. Do you think there's an existential crisis for the Tories?
Potentially, but not for that reason. So I don't... I think that the reform vote is going to be incredibly damaging for this election, but I think a lot of people are aware that it's a sort of right-wing protest vote, essentially. And as soon as the Conservatives are voted out, they don't really have... What are you protesting against? You're protesting against
the opposition
party.
Well, it's funny, because if you combine the reform and the Tory vote, they end up not being that far behind Labour. Mm. So if that vote wasn't splintering and essentially bleeding into reform, they'd be 5, 6, 7 points behind Labour, which, you know, you'd probably still lose a general election going into it like that, but is recoverable. The question is, you talk about protest vote, Is that a short-term protest vote, or are we looking at a long-term split?
So I think it'll be a short-term protest vote. However, I do think that, you know, come the next gen election and from thereafter, the Conservatives will really struggle, because I think that there probably hasn't been enough discussion of the catastrophic brand damage that I think the party has suffered over the past, you know, 2 years or so. And I think, you know, particularly as, you know, demographic shifts, as millennials, you know, already are the biggest voting generation, I struggle to see a situation where a majority of millennials will vote Conservative.
What's that brand damage, you think? Partygate, COVID, the economy, Liz Truss, what are some of the highlights, do you think, as to what damage has been caused, and is there a way back?
So I think Partygate was huge because it sort of framed the pandemic in a sort of permanently negative way. I think that there might have been a sort of an escape route for the Conservatives, at least sort of comms wise, for it being a very difficult situation. But the idea that everyone wasn't in the same boat. I think Liz Truss, again, very damaging, you know, undermining their sort of credibility as the party of economic stability.
And she's still running around talking, which is only doing damage.
And Rishi Sunak hasn't properly denounced her, which, you know, again, suggests that they it's still part of their group. But I think also there's just a sort of long sense throughout this 14-year government that the Conservatives haven't really done anything of use for, you know, younger or even middle-aged people. And I think there's a real sense of betrayal that I'm not sure, you know, beyond any of those sort of specific, you know, set plays, I think will be quite difficult to recover from.
Do you think Rishi has struggled in that it's interesting you say he hasn't properly denounced Liz Truss. He hasn't really set his stall either way. He's tried to please both sides of the party. He's brought David Cameron in, which is on probably the more moderate side of the One Nation Tory party, even though, so, you know, a lot of people would argue his policies in government were very, very, very right wing. But, you know, certainly in the party, he's seen as more moderate. But he's also promoted people like Lee Anderson, who's now gone away, and Jonathan Gullis, for example, and Suella Braverman and others. So he's tried to please both sides of the party. Has he, as a result, really not set his stall either way and ended up pissing off both sides?
I would totally agree, and I think that is symptomatic of Sunak being a man who almost doesn't quite understand what his politics is, bizarrely. You know, I'd say, you know, coming in after Liz Truss, it was probably a near impossible turnaround job, but, you know, still a chance. And, you know, so he had the, you know, Isaac Levido strategy of sort of trying to defend the record and, you know, stability with the Conservatives, chaos with Labour. There was that strategy with the five pledges, and then, you know, during 2023, he was, you know, speaking to Dominic Cummings, it's all about kind of move fast and break things, and then he seems to be going back. So I think he does strike me as a sort of slightly confused politician almost, which, you know, I think has led to these issues for him.
Do you think there's any way back, any chance, anything that they could do to win the next general election? Because the reason this is one of the topics we're discussing is respected pollster John Curtis has said Labour have a 99% chance of winning.
If I was going to put a number on it, I'd say it is about in that region. And I think for the Conservatives to win, it would the ball's in Labour's court to mess it up. And I think it would have to be so significant that it's, I'm not even sure, some kind of crisis about personalities, you know, about Keir Starmer would cut it. Actually, I think it would have to be some kind of institutional Labour crisis, some kind of implosion, which could do it. So I think it you know, you're talking about a real fringe event that could do
and,
it.
And so you think that this could extend beyond the election, and Conservatives could continue to struggle into a Labour term, for example, a first parliament. So does that mean you think that, you know, because there's a lot of thoughts out there that while Labour will win the next general election, they might have a tough time afterwards, because Keir Starmer has also not really set his stall as to what he's going to do, and there isn't a clear plan as to, you know, he keeps saying grow the economy and not really saying how. And there's been some fears on the Labour side that could very quickly collapse in government, because once you actually start enacting, having to do stuff, then they're, you know, the tensions will arise. But do you think that's not the case? Labour might have an easy time in that first parliament.
I don't think it's going to be an easy time. You know, the party have been out of government for a very long time. I think, you know, the lack of a vision, although strategic at the moment, you know, may cause difficulties later on. there are sort of discussions over whether the Conservatives are almost presiding over some kind of scorched earth policy of handing over a real poison chalice that Labour might then struggle to govern. Although by the same token, I think that it could be that the Conservatives lose power almost at sort of peak bad time, and that Labour then, by just implementing sensible policies, could then, you know, people see the benefit from that.
Yeah, and I'm just going to ask you, because I've asked every Week Unwrapped guest, when do you think the election's going to be?
October, November.
I think so too. Okay, we're going to move on to the next story, and it continues on Conservative campaigning strategies, tactics, and perspective. And this is surrounding London, the controversial Conservative attack video that portrayed London as a crime-racked hellhole. Was put together by a central party rather than its mayoral candidate and has dismayed some around Susan Hall, The Guardian has learned and reported. The brief but dramatic film features an American accent voiceover declaring the city the crime capital of the world and, using dubious claims, sought to blame Sadiq Khan. I have been on the edge of a sneeze for like 15 minutes, by the way. That's why you're hearing that in my voice. Anyway, back to the story. While Hall is the main challenger to the incumbent London mayor, in the 2nd of May elections, Tory party sources said that the video was entirely the work of a Conservative campaign headquarters and had not been well received. It does something to make you wonder if there's a Labour mole working in CCHQ, they said. It insulted people's intelligence and it has left some people on her campaign notably pissed off. Ben, I don't know if you've seen this video. It's it looks like something that would come off a really, really bad American political sort of show. And it seems to have gone down entirely wrong. But maybe that's just with more sort of liberal online audiences. What do you make of the video, first of all?
I thought it was in poor taste and well, has backfired. I think, you know, that having an American voiceover, I thought, was quite odd, saying that Sadiq Khan seized power when obviously, you know, he's got more of a democratic mandate than Rishi Sunak. I didn't think that was a particularly sensible thing to
do. Also, the original version of the video had footage from New York, and they had to take it down and then repost it.
Yeah, which doesn't suggest even they have great confidence in the video. As you say, the sort of dubious crime statistics, I don't think that was particularly wise. And I think, you know, as you said, Susan Hall and her team have good reason to be angry about this, because I think she you know, I'm not her biggest fan, but I think she has, for example, when Lee Anderson made his, you know, what I thought were racist comments about Sadiq Khan, she distanced herself from those, which I thought was a commendable thing to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here it looks like, again, she's being undermined by the central party HQ. So she certainly won't be happy. And I think this is, for at least the national campaign, a strategic mistake for them. Because while I think when you've been in government for 14 years, you have to point to your own record, and instead it looks like they're trying to sort of flail around and find examples of Labour doing things that, you know, Labour doing silly things. But I think at some point you've got to face up to the fact that you've been in power and you have to defend that.
Yeah, a lot of the criticisms the video have gotten are not just taste, but some outright false claims. So the video claims that the ultra-low emission zone is being policed by, quote, ULEZ enforcers dressed in black, faces covered in masks. That's not true. The zone isn't enforced by people. It's enforced by using cameras around the country, which anyone who knows anything about ULEZ will know. And I've been critical of ULEZ myself on the show, but, I mean, we're not going to disagree on the colour of the sky. It talks about a sort of crime-ridden capital city, and I think everybody would agree crime is an issue in London, but the data suggests London has one of the lowest levels of antisocial behaviour. 14.9% of people in London experienced crime either to their person or to their household in the year ending September 2023, compared to 15.7% through England and Wales. It has, again, some of the lowest rates. Murder rates has fallen under all three mayors, and has fallen under Sadiq Khan as well. I say all of this because there is a serious concern around truth in politics. And, you know, politics has long had a history, and democracies have long had a strict history of stretching the truth. But we now seem to be way beyond that in our political campaigning and just putting out things that are outright false. How much does that concern you around our political culture?
For sure it's concerning. But by the same token, I don't think it's sort of hugely surprising. This isn't a one-off event. There has been I would say a sort of gradual slide probably since and including the Brexit campaign. But yeah, it's definitely concerning.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to move on to the next story. And again, this plays a little bit into the election prospects because it has been such an important issue for the Conservatives and one that they've spoken about quite recently. A record number of migrants have crossed the English Channel so far this year, according to Provisional Home Office figures. Some 4,644 have made their journey in 2024, a record for the first 3 months of the calendar year. Of the total, 338 people arrived in the UK in 7 boats on Tuesday. The latest data exceeds the previous record high figure of 4,548 for January to March 2022 and had already surpassed the 3,793 arrivals in the first few months of last year. It comes despite Rishi Sunak's ongoing bid to stop the boats and the Prime Minister saying his plan was working. Last week, Downing Street declared the government was dealing with a migration emergency after a record day for crossings. Some 514 people made the journey on 10 boats on the 20th of March, making this the busiest day since the start of the year. Rishi Sunak has made this a key tenet of his essentially election bid. And the campaign slogan seems to be stick to the plan, but the plan's not working.
Yes, he sort of pushed himself into a slightly odd corner whereby, you know, unless a flight takes off to Rwanda, it seems like he is sort of, his premiership has failed, which does seem like an unwise position to be in. But I think on this issue, at least, it does feel like, you know, both, I'm not sure either party has really kind of fully grappled with both the scale and the future scale of this issue and really come up with credible policies. You know, for me, I think Rwanda was always a sort of a laughable plan. But by the same token, I think Keir Starmer's sort of approach of trying to, you know, smash the gangs, as he says, I don't really see how that is demonstrably different to what's been tried in mm-hmm. recent years.
So why has Rishi Sunak gone all in on, because it seems like this is the policy that he's gone all in on. Why has he done that? He must have some confidence and some flights will take off to Rwanda.
Well, I think it was a strategic error. But if we believe what we read, it was a call made by the advisor Will Tanner, and he thought that
it's a wedge issue.
Yeah, it's a wedge. So a wedge issue and you know, it almost, I suppose, a bit like the prorogation of Parliament. It sort of, in that instance, they probably made the call that it didn't really matter if it was illegal or not, because it just showed that they were, you know, trying to sort of push through, you know, the blob or, you know, the establishment or whatever you want to call it. But I think in this instance, it just looks like they don't have a grip on the establishment, which they've had 14 years to mould.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like these are two different issues. There's the conversation around migration and whether it's too high or not, benefits of migration, all that kind of stuff. The boats is a very, very separate issue, because I think whether left, right, whatever you might think, nobody thinks that crossing the channel on these dinghies is a good idea for anybody. Now, some on the left will call for safe passage, while some on the right might be calling to put an end to it in France. Is there anything, I mean, we talk about, a lot of the solutions to this are based on an election, right? So Rishi will be saying, stop the boats, we'll do everything we can to stop the boats. Keir's talking about smashing the gangs. Is there an actual solution to this problem?
Well, so I think my view on this has changed, in that I'm not convinced that a solution lies within the European Court of Human Rights, in that I don't see a system whereby, like, it's almost impossible to sort of get people out of the UK once they come in here is workable. I think that the solution of trying to almost build a higher and higher wall or a sort of deeper and deeper moat across the channel, I think that's been shown not to work, because people,
not just here, in other countries as
for
well.
For sure, you know, I think it's really in anything, it creates humanitarian issues, because it makes it harder and harder for people who are probably going to make the journey anyway, and it's been shown not to be a deterrent. So you're just pushing people through more and more dangerous situations.
So surely it makes more sense then to make sure that these people don't die in the channel, given that they're going to make the journey anyway. They're desperate. I mean, we can have a discussion as to why they're making it, but I don't want to do that right now. They're going to make the journey anyway. Surely it makes sense. There is merit to the argument that there should be some safety and passage to make sure that kids don't die in the channel.
I entirely agree.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a safe and legal way to get here, and then there's also got to be a way of getting people out who got here legally. Mm-hmm. And I think you've got to do both to
well, solve their it. Asylum claims and their refugee claims will have to be assessed and then decisions be made. But that can't be done. It has to be done onshore, right? Because the Rwanda plan suggests it'd be done offshore.
Yeah, I agree. I think, particularly sort of doing it half the world away seems crazy. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the final story. We've got a little bit of time that we're going to touch on this. I didn't think we'd get time. The UK government has formally accused China of being behind what it called malicious cyber campaigns against MPs and the Electoral Commission. Two people and a company have been sanctioned over cyber attacks. Deputy PM Oliver Dowden said that they were behind attempts to access details of MPs critical of Beijing, as well as the data of potentially 40 million voters. The Chinese embassy in the UK says that these are completely unfounded claims amounting to malicious slander. The UK sanctions will freeze assets, barring UK citizens and businesses from handling their funds or resources. A travel ban will also prevent them from entering or remaining in the UK. The UK will not tolerate malicious cyber activity, Mr. Dowden said. It is an absolute priority for the UK government to protect our democratic systems and values. We had a huge scandal and story over Russian interference in the elections, both here and in the United States, over the last couple of cycles. We're now getting accusations and allegations of China being behind similar, if not more difficult, malicious cyber campaigns against MPs and the Electoral Commission. How concerned are you of foreign interference in our elections?
I think it's reasonable to be very concerned, and I think it's disappointing that I don't think the words of, you know, the likes of Oliver Dowden have really matched the actions and the response. You know, the sanctions only apply to two individuals, which, you know, seems laughable really when there is an entire sort of government and state behind these. So I think a lot of people have been calling for China to be added to, I think it's called the enhanced tier, which would basically broaden it out from individuals to any government-backed sort of group or organisation. Mm-hmm. So I think that seems sensible. And then I think we also need to, you know, learn the lessons of Russia, that sort of liberal internationalism, it doesn't work in all cases if not everyone is playing fair, and that it is probably a time to start thinking about, at least in certain instances, sort of strategic decoupling.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because, you know, I'm looking at this and seeing that there were attempts to access details of MPs, which are sort of the pillars, you know, they're the legislatures of our government and our parliament, and they attempted to access potentially 40 million voters. Yeah. It seems the response we have is disproportionate, given they're attacking the very institution in which our political establishment and political institutions are built.
For sure. So 40 million people's data potentially at risk, and you've got two people, you know, two Chinese individuals getting any repercussions.
That's not a proportionate response.
It certainly isn't. I think we do need to up the ante here.
Okay, thank you so much. That was political commentator Ben Cope joining us in the studio to talk about everything from the Conservatives' election hopes, if there are any, the controversial attacks on Sadiq Khan, as well as the English Channel, the migration crisis, and China and the malicious cyber campaigns. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to stay on this story of the Conservative Party and their prospects in the general election and what it might look like after. This comes as respected pollster Sir John Curtis has said that Labour has a 99% chance of winning the next general election. Joining me after the break will be Professor Mark Garnett, senior lecturer at Lancaster University and co-author of Keeping the Red Flag Flying, the Labour Party in Opposition Since 1922, which will be published next month. Mark will be joining me after these messages.
Hey! FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you thought, I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running round.
Except you wouldn't be 80 years old.
I'd be 26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored.
Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing "Oh Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. We wrote, the office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it's really necessary for them to come.
The Dating Show.
I'm friends with a fair few exes, and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
Well, I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like, if you've already shagged, isn't that a bit weird?
I think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level. You can be friends with someone. You can't be, like, best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
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 Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
It's Ali Milani on Politics Uncensored at FUBAR Radio. We are talking about the Conservative Party. More Conservative members of Parliament are standing down ahead of the looming general election than at any national vote since the party plunged to a landslide defeat in 1997. Robert Halfen and James Heapy's announcement yesterday has brought the number up to 63, the most since 1997. They are really running. It comes as respected pollster Sir John Curtis has said that Labour have a 99% chance of winning the next general election, which is supposedly scheduled for November. He's given the Conservative Party 1% chance of winning that general election. Joining me now is Professor Mark Garnett, Senior Lecturer at Lancaster University and co-author of Keeping the Red Flag Flying, the Labour Party in Opposition Since 1922, which will be published next month. Professor Garnett, thank you so much for joining us. Do you concur with Sir John Curtis on the 99% chance of Labour winning the next general election?
It's a very bold prediction from Sir John, because politics is obviously an extremely hazardous business. Nobody really makes a huge amount of money betting on politics. But I think he might be a bit generous to the Conservatives there, thinking that they have a 1% chance of winning, because if he's predicting an obvious win for Labour, the reason why he's doing that is because it does now seem that, like in 1997, the Conservatives have reached a stage where whatever they do, they're not going to impress the public. They're flatlining in the polls, whatever happens. And so if I were to make any guess on the basis that nothing can happen to improve things for the Conservatives, then really the odds of them winning, I would have thought that one percentage chance is a bit generous. I would have thought it was closer to zero.
Yeah, no, I think everybody's with you on that. We've been talking a little bit on the show today around what does that mean for the Conservatives, given that so many of them are jumping ship. There has been a lot of conversations in Westminster and in the media this week about whether this is just a Conservative Party that's at the end of its tenure after 14 years of government and needs to come out of government to redefine itself, ready to fight the next general election? Or is this an existential crisis for the Conservative Party, given it's got reform getting closer and closer in the rearview mirror? Do you think that this will be just a bad day at the office for the Conservatives and, following a tired government and people looking for a natural change? Or is this an existential crisis?
A very interesting question. If we go back to 1997, it felt like the party was almost on its last legs, that it was having a real existential crisis. But what happened then was the party elected, the parliamentary party elected William Hague as leader. And some people referred to him as John Major with A-levels. In other words, they picked a leader who in many respects was a pragmatist, a bit like John Major. I don't think that anything like that will happen this time round. I think that the momentum within the party is very much moving to the right. even further than it had done under people like Ian Duncan Smith and Michael Howard. And therefore, I think already the party is split because Boris Johnson evicted 21, I think, MPs, all of whom were sensible moderates in the from the perspective of the old Tory party anyway. They were mainstream conservatives. And those people are now no longer in Parliament. People like George Osborne, Amber Rudd, those people have left the Conservative Party. So what you're left with is already a party which is a bit like the old UKIP. And I think that that will be consolidated after the next election, because it seems that the, let's say, the right of the party are the ones with the fresh ideas. The moderates, the centrists, the old One Nation people don't really seem to have very many answers. And therefore, I could see there being really a realignment. Now, people have predicted this so many times and it never happens, but I can't really see it not happening this time, because the party contains within its ranks, or its former ranks, people who don't belong, really, who are more opposed to one another even than some Labour members and Conservative members. It used to be a broad church, the Conservative Party. Now it's really much more like a narrow sect in terms of the people who are in Parliament. And so I think that the people who've been evicted from the party because of its move to the right will want to come back into politics. They might want to reclaim the name Conservative. But the people who currently have the whip hand in the party really are much more like the old UKIP. And you can see all kinds of things happening after the next election, particularly because Reform UK, the new UKIP, as it were, will probably cause fatal damage to the Conservatives. And some realignment around that position, the Farage position, does seem to be likely for really what is now the majority of the Conservative Party.
Okay, Mark, let's do some speculation. I like to speculate. And look, the Tories have lost the general election. I don't think that's in much doubt. What you've said is really, really interesting. The question is, how does that play out? Is it more likely that Reform UK and the Conservatives merge, or the next leader of the Conservative Party is in essence basically a Reform candidate, and therefore everybody folds into the Conservative Party, and the existential crisis we're talking about isn't a new party but the actual face of the Tory party completely shifting? Or is it likely that a bunch of, you know, that Reform may pull so closely to the Conservatives that you see a bunch of Tories leave and actually join the brand new brand of the Reform, and we might see a new opposition party in the country not being the Conservatives and being Reform instead? Which one do you think is more likely? Or does it matter really, because it's
again,
the same result?
Another very, very, very interesting question. There have been so many kind of semi-feelers put out to Nigel Farage. Obviously, as an ex-Conservative in the good old days of the Conservative Party, he'd be regarded as a turncoat and a traitor and not to be touched without contamination. But the idea of a realignment with Farage in some kind of a position, he may not want to be in Parliament. He might prefer just being in the media now or whatever. But his politics really are the same, indistinguishable from a very large number of Conservative MPs. Now, again, there have been attempts to get Conservatives to think about changing the name of the party for a very long time. And really, you've got to ask yourself, Conservative is obviously is a big popular word in America, but it doesn't really apply to our party, the party of that name. They don't really want to conserve anything at all, except perhaps for their own seats. So you could see, I mean, obviously, there was a meeting recently in London to launch the Popular Conservatives. You could see something like that, a renaming of what was the Conservative Party. But it would be, I mean, it's already a different party. Mm-hmm. The party, the old Conservative Party, has already gone down the Swanee. And so I would think the realignment will be there'll be a far right party which may try to capture the name Conservative, and then there will be a realignment in the centre, it seems to me. And whether that involves the Lib Dems. I mean, there were attempts at the time of the last election to have a realignment with the independents who stood unsuccessfully. I mean, in the end, that my point would be not to speculate really about the name of the party or whatever, but that there will be a formalization of a realignment, which has already been underway for quite some considerable time, because that party contains within it people who, if they lead the party in a pragmatic direction, like Rishi Sunak has done, they get knifed by the right. And it cannot remain as a political entity with any constructive purpose while it contains people who are so sharply divided. People like Jeremy Hunt and Jacob Rees-Mogg do not belong in the same organisation. Some would say they don't belong in the same century.
Yeah, so I guess my next question is, what does this mean for a potential Labour government, given that there might be a sort of complete right-wing knife fight after a Labour government's put in place? Could it be, you know, kind of smooth sailing for a Labour government who, you know, the Conservatives might be too busy attacking Reform and Reform attacking Conservatives, and the Tories and the general right of the country trying to figure out what the future looks like while Labour are in government? Because there has been a lot of people on the left, and I use the left term broadly, that say one of the things that Labour might struggle with is Keir Starmer hasn't said a whole bunch. And while there is a massive anti-Tory, anti-Conservative sentiment amongst the voters, that might shift once Labour come into government and are expected to actually do things, and therefore they might get into some trouble electorally. What do you think, basically, your view on what all of this means for Labour in government?
Right. Well, on the face of it, you would think it means an easy ride politically, because, as in 1997, the Tories really were in disarray. It took them until 2005 to choose a leader who was remotely electable in David Cameron. That was 8 years where New Labour was really almost without opposition, effective opposition. And so you could say that Keir Starmer has got 5 years definitely in order to establish governing competence. All that time, if things go wrong, he can say, well, at least we're not the Tories. And people will, I'm sure, respond to that message, because the Tories have had 14 years to make the brand extremely toxic. So he's got some space, I think. And again, this is assuming there definitely will be a Labour government with a comfortable majority. And the thing about Starmer, although he hasn't transformed the party in the way he claims to have done, he has certainly evoked something like the mood of the 90s, where the people who disliked the policies of Tony Blair basically kept quiet because they knew that that was the only way to make sure they could get rid of the Tories. So, in other words, I can't really see him having terrible trouble with his parliamentary party. His best asset will be the Conservatives, because there is so limited room for manoeuvre for Starmer once he gets into office that he'll have to damp down expectations. But if he establishes some kind of a competence narrative, as it were, if it looks like he is a safe pair of hands, then all the time he can be saying things will look up eventually, just bide with me, because the alternative is the rabble who couldn't even stay united as a party, let alone govern the country. So I think that Starmer obviously is nothing like as popular as Blair. It's not the 90s in that respect. It's not this kind of great feeling that there's a new dawn. But what there is a complete lack of respect for the Conservative Party, from which Labour can only benefit. As I say, as long as things don't go really badly wrong in Starmer's first term, he will be able to get away with excuses, look at the mess the Tories left for us, that kind of thing. And so he's got one term for definite to establish himself as somebody who's worth keeping faith with for another term.
One might ask if Keir Starmer is the most lucky politician in history, because he's now got a 99% chance of winning a general election, and potentially, just don't don't mess things up too badly and you might be all right for re-election. Thank you so much. That was really insightful. That was Professor Mark Garnett, senior lecturer at Lancaster University and co-author of a new book that's coming out. Make sure you can grab a copy, Keeping the Red Flag Flying, The Labour Party in Opposition Since 1922. It's going to be published next month. Thank you so much, Professor Mark Garnett. We're going to do a quick shift. We're going to stay in Westminster, but we're going to go from the House of Lords, the House of Commons, into the House of Lords. We're cross-going on the other side of the road. And we're going to be speaking to one of the youngest, well, now formerly become the youngest peer in the House of Lords. At 28 years old, she took the seat in the Lords on Wednesday. Just to note, the average age of the House of Lords is 71. I was a little bit shocked that it was that low, to be honest. They look about 96, most of them, but hey-ho. And funnily enough, I have a little bit of a history with our next guest, Baroness Carmen Smith, Plaid Cymru peer, who is now formerly the youngest peer in the House of Lords. We were officers together at the National Union of Students not long ago. Carmen, or Baroness Smith, I must call you now. How are you keeping?
Great, thank you. And yeah, it's lush to see you again. And thank you for inviting me on.
It's brilliant to see you. And I was shocked, to be honest, just to see that you had become a peer. Tell us a little bit about how it all went down. How did it start? How did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, so I think if you told me a year ago that I would be entering the House of Lords, I wouldn't have believed you, to be honest. It's not a place that I believe in. How it happened is, so I'm a member of Plaid Cymru. So one party of two in the UK that have an internal process for appointments to the Lords. So the other party, the Green Party, also have an internal process. And basically what happened was, so my party sent out an email to all our members on the National Register to be like, oh, we want to elect a new list to submit names to when we're asked to the Lords. I saw the email and at first I was just like, oh God, I presume it's going to be, your usual suspects that will be appointed to the position. And I started talking with some mainly women within the party who basically encouraged me to put my name in. At first I was like, no, definitely not. And after a few conversations, they convinced me. That's the story of a lot of people who enter like politics or new roles, is that, someone encourages them to do so.
And I think you have spoken publicly about some of the backlash you've gotten as a young woman that's gone into this high profile role. Tell us a little bit about what that's been like.
Yeah, so going into it, I did expect to receive some backlash. I think all young women entering politics always know that is going to be the case, unfortunately. And I consider myself really resilient, but I guess you don't know what it feels like until it actually happens. And I mean, at first, in terms of the backlash received, it was hurtful. I did reconsider whether it was the right thing to do for me anymore. But then, I've got some great friends and family who supported me, and actually I reminded myself why I'm doing it. And I'm doing it to shake things up, and I'm doing it to hopefully, do a good job that then the next person from, an unrepresented background going into politics doesn't get as much stick. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing it to make a difference.
You know, Carmen, I have a lot of, we try to bring a lot of young voices, people from unconventional backgrounds to get involved in politics onto the show. And it's always the same themes. It's everybody tells you to get involved and they want more young voices and they want more women. They want more people from ethnic minorities to get involved until you actually do it. Then when you do it and you actually achieve any semblance of political power or political office, then the sort of swathes of backlash will hit you. There'll be lots of young people listening or watching what you're doing now. Would you maintain an encouragement of them to get involved in the political system and in the structures, or has your experience soured you to that?
No, definitely. I think we need more young voices in politics, and that's something that I'm hoping to do in my new role as well, is to offer those opportunities to offer young people, whether they, in terms of shadowing opportunities too within the Lords, but also I'm supporting, young women in my community to stand for selection and election. And the only way we can change this system is by being in the system and changing it from within, and that's what I fundamentally believe. But it is hard, we can do it by getting involved and taking over.
Mm. I like that. So I think you took your seat on Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken.
I was introduced on Thursday last week.
Thursday last morning. Week. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's been about a week. Talk us through what it's been like. You put one of those fancy robes on. What's it actually like walking around the building, talking to people? Be honest. I'll give you an example. Carmen, we had Dawn Butler in, who's an MP, and she told me when she first came into the House of Commons, she was mistaken for a cleaner, for example. And those are the sort of experiences of people who aren't conventionally in politics, and that's the sort of response. I can only imagine it's worse in the House of Lords because it's such an outdated system full of 105-year-old people who've been there forever. So I just, quite honest assessment, in a week, what have you seen, what have you experienced, what has it felt like?
Yeah, I mean, it's been super strange. I think the only thing, I guess, that's keeping me sane is I guess viewing it as starting a new job. You're not going to know everything, and also you are going to get lost, especially around the Parliament. It's such a complicated building. In terms of what you mentioned there, in terms of Dawn's experience before, on my introduction day on the Thursday, I was, rushing about doing lots of things, and I ran through central lobby for something because I was late somewhere, and a police officer stopped me. I think he just saw red hair, just really fast, running fast, and was just like, "Who's this?"
Yeah.
So he stopped me, but I thought he was actually quite rude at first, as in the way it was but then as soon as I turned around and he saw my lanyard and my pass and that I was a peer, completely different
but
story.
I mean,
it was "Oh, ma, my lady, I'm sorry." And that was quite weird, for lots of reasons. One, I mean, obviously being stopped in your place of work, but also just the change of tone as soon as it was realised that I, was a member.
Yeah. What's striking about that comment is they will have, let's be honest, they would have looked at you as a young woman and gone, "Doesn't belong here," right? Or wouldn't have thought that you would be a peer or a lord. And so that's why you would have gotten stopped. I'm sure if you were, let's be frank, a 70-year-old man who was, running would be kind, but running across.
Maybe
stop
running.
Yeah, maybe jogging to where you need to be. You probably won't get stopped. So those are the kind of real experiences that you would experience, right?
And it's a weird place. I mean, you mentioned also the robe and stuff. So it was obviously really uncomfortable and unnatural. It's not like I've worn a robe and had to swear allegiance to the king before. Mm-hmm. So it's not exactly your normal day, but I guess there was a few things that I was was in my control, but I tried to make it a bit more actually me. So I requested fake fur as well for animal welfare reasons, so I didn't wear
can you do that,
the fake fur robes, and I got to do my oath in Welsh, and that's important to me as
I didn't know that you could request a non-animal fur. Something's just crossed my mind, because knowing you and knowing Plaid Cymru's position, is it difficult to swear allegiance to the king? I mean, I hope that's not a difficult, I imagine it's not a difficult question.
It's part of the process. I mean, to me, in terms of any, I believe that when you're a politician swearing into parliament, in any parliament, you should, to be honest, be swearing allegiance to citizens and people, because that's what you're there to do, is represent them. So I do think it's quite a strange thing to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that in a modern democracy, we should change how, you know, we pledge allegiance, that it should be to people. Yeah, the constituents that people are elected by.
OK, one more question about your experiences since Thursday. I'm fascinated about it. Interactions with other lords. Any interesting, funny stories, anything that comes to mind about conversations you might have had with some of the more long-standing peers, let's say?
So everyone's been really friendly. I mean, there's a few people have obviously come up to me and go like, oh, I can't wait to hear about your abolition plans. And, you know, perhaps maybe in a sarcastic tone, I'm not 100% sure, probably. But I mean, everyone has been friendly. And that is something that, to be honest, is important to me in politics, is I'm going in there not to, be difficult about it. I'm going in there to make a difference. So to make a difference, you have to form alliances with sometimes people that you might disagree with, but you probably will agree with on some areas. And that's what I want to do, is to build, you know, quite a good reputation there in terms of getting stuff done, because otherwise I won't get anything done.
Yeah,
and one voice as well.
You mentioned abolition, and I want to kind of, that's what I want to ask our next and probably final question actually is, The House of Lords is interesting because there is a large swathe of the general population, of political actors, parties and others who believe in that it should be gotten rid of. It's an undemocratic chamber and quite outdated for many people. What's your position on that, and how will that position inform how you will act as a peer?
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret. I don't believe in the House of Lords, and most people within my party don't believe in the House of Lords. And I guess I'll take it in two parts, that kind of, and like the why, I guess. One is I believe in an independent Wales. So, and in an independent Wales, I don't think we can have a House of Lords in terms of the modern democracy that we create. And hopefully that what that democracy looks like is that it's close to the people, in terms of perhaps like around citizens' assemblies and that kind of, you know, democracy. And then in terms of actually, so the House of Lords as it is, I mean, it is, it's the largest upper chamber in the world, and the second largest legislative chamber in the world as well. I don't believe that there should be an unelected chamber anywhere in the world. So, you know, just fundamentally. And then in terms of what should happen next, you know, I think that the, you know, Westminster parties need to move on this. It's not a question of if, it's more like when, like constitutional change is necessary. I mean, look, our system is so dated in terms of, well, there's like 800 sitting members. Is that really, you know, what we need as a chamber, especially it's 70% men. The average age is 71. It doesn't represent our population. There's a few things that, you know, could be done immediately, if not full change. I mean, like halving the size of the chamber to similar size of the Commons, removing hereditary peers. Do we believe people should just be born into roles?
For those who might not know what that is, so hereditary peers are given the role as a result of what family they're born in, and I think Carmen quite rightly pointed at the beginning of the interview that Plaid Cymru and the Greens are only the two parties that have internal processes for getting people to the Lords. Everyone else, it's a completely unelected system where you go in based on party leadership and or your, again, the family money that you're born in and the money that you might have. Sorry, Carmen, but just so listeners know, go ahead. You were saying.
Oh no! I think that was really helpful, and like you just said there, in terms of the usual appointments to the place are by the big parties as friends, and whether that like they're the big donors, the mates of like big political parties. That is why, you know, I don't believe in that chamber in terms of how it's been like created, but yeah, and we need to push forward reform. And unfortunately, the big parties don't feel like, you know, that they want to. Because they, you know, and that's why we have to talk about it.
Yeah, one last thing. We've spoken about abolition, but I'm going to squeeze one last question in. What would success look like for you in your role as a peer? What are a few things that you'd like to accomplish, whether that's for Wales, for Plaid Cymru members, or wherever that may be? What would success look like?
And thank you. No, great question. So because of the weird conventions in the Lords, I can't contribute yet in terms of like the chamber until I deliver a maiden speech. And that'll be in like a couple of weeks time. So after Easter now, because of the recess. And something that I think that I'd like to do my maiden speech on is on affordable housing. And so what I would like to contribute, I guess, in the while it exists, is be a voice for our generation in terms of, you know, their soaring rents, with the cost of living crisis as well, and climate change, and the lack of, I guess, action taken on these like key matters that you know, that our generation just don't feel listened to. So those are the types of things that I want to raise there and give that perspective, but also a perspective from, you know, my own life experiences as a young carer growing up. They're not unique experiences, and people are struggling every day, and I hope to kind of give that lens into the chamber and make a difference through raising those matters.
Amazing. And I think we have heard it numerous times on the show that housing tends to be, if not number one, in the top three most important issues to young people, wherever they are in the country. And so it's an incredibly important issue. Thank you so much. That's Baroness Carmen Smith, Plaid Cymru peer, one of the youngest peer in the House of Lords. Carmen, from I think it was NUS conference we first saw each other. Now you're in the House of Commons, and I can formally change your name on my the House of Lords, and I can formally change your name on my phone to Baroness Smith, and I shall refer to you in that title in the future. Thank you so much for joining us. We've had a really interesting, wide-ranging discussion today from the House of Lords to the Commons, the future of the Conservative Party, as well as speaking to Ben Cope, political commentator. We're going to round off the show after this.
FUBAR Radio presents As Handsome As You Imagine.
What did you have for breakfast that morning?
Almost certainly a pie.
For breakfast?
Yeah, because we started really, really early, right, at the butcher's. Yeah. We started proper early, like 7 o'clock. I would have had at least 6 pies.
A day?
A day.
That is a lot of pies.
No, no, because we sold them at the shop.
That is a legitimate answer to the question, who ate all the pies? Yeah.
From 1 p.m. every Monday.
This is Ali Milani. We've just been speaking to Baroness Carmen Smith. It's so weird to speak to someone who you kind of grew up with in the political world now as a Lord, referring to her as Baroness Carmen Smith. But she's the youngest peer in the House of Lords. Let's get that correct. And she's just spoken to us about her experience. It's interesting. We talk about different guests from Dawn to Carmen and others. People from non-traditional backgrounds always have the same sort of experiences when they enter politics. And that's one where the system doesn't think that they belong. So I'm sure we'll get Baroness Smith back on the show to tell us a little bit more about her experiences once she's been properly settled into the system. Funnily enough, we've been speaking in the studio just before the show around some of these institutional rules and laws that might exist. I've just found out today that at some point you need to wear a hat in the House of Commons, or a top hat, to make certain movements or certain contributions. I had no idea until just now that Carmen was telling us about the robes, and you could get non-animal fur ones, you can do it in Welsh and other things. So we're going to try and put together a little video for everybody to talk through some of these old school conventions and rules that most of us probably don't know and haven't engaged with. It's been a top show today, lots of things discussed. As we get closer to the general election, it seems like the result is more and more clear. What isn't clear about is what the future would look like for these mainstream parties, whether a Labour victory and first term into government will be easy riding given Conservative collapse, what will happen between the Tories and Reform, where Nigel Farage sits, what the future of the Conservative Party sits, and who benefits really from that. If that centre sort of right is evacuated by the Conservative Party and they do go hard right, is it the Liberal Democrats that benefit from that? Is it the Green Party or is it the Labour Party? And I'm sure we'll continue to discuss those issues and that future on the show. We've got really exciting shows coming up for you after the Easter break, including discussions with London mayoral candidates and others. So make sure you tune in every week on Thursday between 5 to 6 on FUBAR Radio. I want to thank my guests, Professor Mark Garnett, senior lecturer at Lancaster University and co-author of the upcoming book, Keeping the Red Flag Flying, the Labour Party in Opposition Since 1922. That's going to be published next month. He joined us on the show. Baroness Carmen Smith, Plaid Cymru peer, youngest House of Lords member who just joined us, and political commentator Ben Cope, who joined us for the Week Unwrapped as we discussed the top issues in our politics. You can follow the show at Politics Uncensored UK on Instagram, on Twitter, on and on TikTok. Follow all of our different clips, make sure to share and subscribe. Leave a review on all your good podcasting networks where you can catch previous episodes, including shows where we've spoken to the most senior members of all political parties and none, and journalists. Make sure to listen to all of those episodes on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or any good podcasting platform. I've been Ali Milani. This is Politics Uncensored. Salams.